So for all those people that went out this year and got flu shots like myself, it was reassuring to hear that it was 9% effective. And I don't remember that coming out at the beginning of the flu season. I thought it was like this was the perfect mix, and there'd be no way you'd get sick. So such is life. Huh? So I've been working on a couple songs. I thought I'd try to entertain you before the Dharma talk. And it always gives me a chance to practice in public, because in private I'm really good. So this is an old Dylan song that some of you might remember, and others probably weren't born, but... They say everything can be replaced, yet every distance is not near. That's why I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my light come shining from the west on to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released. They say every man needs protection. They say every man must fall. Yet I swear I see my reflection someplace so high above this wall. I see my light come shining from the west on to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released. Yeah. Hey, Bob. So does anybody remember that song? By Dylan? Okay. Walter Trout, the famous blues guitar player, plays that as well on his electric guitar with his band. Sounds really good. Mine was good enough. So the next song is something I think it's like really important to hear again, because if anybody's been keeping track of the news, North Korea is playing around with atom bombs, you know? And I thought that was like over. 1962, 1963, when I was just a young whippersnapper, and we had they had the Cuban crisis, and people were just like freaking out because they thought like, this is the end. You know, we're all gonna go. And I remember people actually had bomb shelters in their backyard and fully stocked, just so they could go in and survive. I'm thinking in 2013, we've come a long way. Most of us don't have bomb shelters, and most of us would run towards the light and become stardust. Be a good way to go. So this is a song that Barry McGuire sang. But I had to change a couple of the words because it was a little antiquated, and so I brought it up to speed. So this is the 2013 version. Eastern world is exploding. There is violence flaring, bullets loading. Old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? Even the Jordan River's got those bodies floating. And you tell me over and over again, my friend, why you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Can't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears that I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no place to hide when the world's in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Well, I'm so mad my blood's a coagulating. I'm just a sitting here a contemplating. You can twist the truth, it knows no regulation. And a handful of senators don't pass legislation. Marches alone can't fix immigration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate that lives deep inside you, then take a look around, for kindness can guide you. You can leave here for 5 days in space. When you return, it's the same damn place. Rounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And you tell me over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Does anybody remember that one? No, that's new too. Okay, wow, I'm getting old.
Who's that by?
What's that?
Who was that by?
That's by Barry McGuire. I think it was 1969. And it was a hit for a long time. Older than that? Okay, I am getting old then. Okay, 67, 68?
No, 66.
Okay, cool. It was so nice that the... I'm sorry?
You left out the Red China Selma, Alabama.
Right? I did. It's 2013. Yeah. So I talked about immigration and yeah. It works better that way for me now. But at the time, it made perfect sense. Okay, well, you know, this is going to be, I'm doing a series of talks at IBMC on Thursday nights, and we're studying a book, and Jan feels so lonely because there's only like three or four of us here, and he keeps telling all his friends to come, and he can't find parking, and nobody, you know, but people keep showing up in spite of all that stuff. And so one of the chapters has to do with three very important characteristics of Zen. This is going to be about Zen today. And even though I'm ordained in the Vietnamese Zen tradition, my teacher came from Sri Lanka. So I have like a really strong Theravada influence. And that's pretty much how I understand Buddhism. But I can appreciate Zen. I can appreciate what it does for people. Now, the word Zen simply means meditation in Japanese. And in Chinese, Chan means meditation, and in English, meditation means meditation. So as a famous Zen master once said, my miracle is that when I'm hungry, I eat, and when I'm tired, I sleep. Even so, a Zen proverb says that a Zen student must have great faith, great doubt, and great determination. A related Chan saying, the Chinese Zen, says that the four prerequisites for practice are great faith, great doubt, great vow, and great vigor. So I'm going to talk about those four today. Great faith, great doubt, great vow, and great vigor. And see if we can make sense of it and see how it might apply to our practice and to our eventual liberation. So, great faith. One of the reasons I became a Buddhist is because I didn't have faith. And all my Christian friends were a little disappointed with my lack of faith. And they say, well, how can you be a Christian if you don't have faith? And I said, I don't know. But I guess I could be a Buddhist. You know? And then I find that even in Buddhism, we need a little faith. And they call it great faith, but I'm going to change it to just, you need some faith. Because in the beginning, you need enough faith to think that maybe some human who walked this earth was able to find his or her full perfection. So we have Siddhartha Gautama, later called the Buddha, and it's been recorded in 100 books, Pali Canon, that like he was the guy. He found a way to self-realize. He found a way to wake up, to see the true nature of the world around him. Never to suffer again, to end his karma, never to be reborn again. And so when I read the statement, I thought, well, that makes perfect sense. I believe that. I have faith in that. And I was surprised to hear from people who were far more intelligent and worldly than I was that, you know what, it's just written down in a book. It doesn't really mean that it's true. But I wanted to believe that was true, because if it was true, in some way, it allowed me to achieve what he did, because I realized that I was simply a human being, and I had a lot of stuff to work out. And I just, a couple weeks ago, posted a picture of me in the 1980s. And I look sort of like, you know, Magnum P.I., in a way, and one fellow put below that picture, solving crime one breath at a time. I thought it was clever. And then somebody else said, well, why did you look like that in the 80s? You know? I said, well, it was the 80s, and I was in somebody training. I wanted to be somebody, and that's the somebody that manifested. He's now dead, of course, and this one has taken his place. But the mustache was cool, and the hair was nice. And I don't know, it was good. So I'm thinking, you know, if somebody did achieve their perfection, did they have to really transform themselves as much as I had to transform myself from the 80s to 2013? Probably even more so. That all the lifetimes they had been somebody led them in that direction, but it didn't lead them to the realization. So in this lifetime, to have faith that it might be possible by following the teachings of Siddhartha, who may have existed and achieved Buddhahood, all that faith necessary to believe that might get us on the path, might allow us to take that first step. Then we have to have faith in our teacher. You know? Oh. You know how many teachers there are out there? And they all say they're the best. You know? And they all have their own little take on it. And some have like really expensive retreats and some have reasonable retreats. And some look really cool and some don't look so cool. I don't know if anybody remembers Rama, R-A-M-A. This was, again, back in the 70s. Still has websites online. He had the coolest Caucasian natural you ever saw. It was like this big. And in a lot of his pictures, it was backlit, so it sort of glowed like an aura. You know? And he just looked good. And he said, what I need is 100 students to pay me $1,000 a year for my teachings. And he found them. Whoa, how cool is that? $100,000 just to start out the year with, you know? Okay. He was eventually discredited for not being exactly who he said he was, and but what a journey he had. So here we are trying to pick out our teachers. How do we, you know, do we look at their resume, their bio, you know? Say, okay, this guy is cool, you know. Some of us don't live close to teachers. Some of us live far away from teachers. We have to make great effort to go there. Some of us don't even have teachers in the same state, it seems. You know, you get to Oklahoma or Kansas or places like that. Geez, they got like two teachers in the whole state. And so how do you pick your teacher? And do you need faith in that teacher? The faith necessary to say, well, maybe he can lead me in a direction that will benefit me. But then as we become a little wiser and more mature, then we say, can he tell me how he did it so I can decide whether I want to do it that way or not? Because sometimes, I wrote this down, the best teacher helps us wake up but doesn't tell us what to see. You know, so they get us started, they wake us up, and then it's sort of up to us because each one of us is unique karmically, to say the least. And we all have different stuff to work out before we achieve our full realization. So nobody that I've ever met has ever been able to tell me exactly what I needed. Now, some have tried, but they told me what they thought I needed. And at that point, there was an immediate deafness that appeared in my ears, and I couldn't even read their lips anymore. So I have always chosen teachers that I thought I could leave. That if it just turned out not to be a good teacher, that it was okay for me to go. And sometimes if you accept a teacher, like a Zen master or Tibetan Lama, you know, who's considered to be a yogi and a guru of sorts, then it's like really, really hard to leave. Now, I mentioned this during December that I, for some reason this year, or 2012, December of 2012, I was watching suicide videos. And I don't know why, it just sort of caught my fancy. So I found Jim Jones, you know, and I watched the hour and a half documentary of Jim Jones and his group, 800 people committing suicide. And then Heaven's Gate, right down like San Diego. Nike sneakers, remember that? Yeah. And what really tripped me out, especially with Heaven's Gate, is they interviewed everybody before the mass suicide. And to a person, they said, I'm doing this of my own free will. That I see the importance of killing myself so I can go to the comet. Because that's where I came from. So I want to go back there. You know, as if they weren't going to die anyway. You know, and so I'm thinking to myself, not one of them left. They sat on the chair and looked in the camera and said, I'm happy to kill myself. I would have been more surprised after watching that if somebody got up and said, hey, listen, I'm not going to kill myself. I got stuff to do. Oscars are on tonight. I want to watch them, you know? So sometimes when we have faith in the teacher, we have to be able to say, okay, I also need my discernment. I also need to be a little skeptical. And now we come to great doubt. And isn't it ironic that we have great faith and great doubt? Because they don't seem to really go together very well. But if you think about it, you can't have one without the other. So great doubt plays an important role in our spiritual maturity, maturation, our path, because we need that discernment. Now, if you've been following the news lately, Sasaki Roshi, wow, huh? Mount Baldy Zen Center, guy's like 105. And for the last 20 years, he's been groping women. And all his women students are coming out saying, he groped me. I thought it was sort of a test to see, you know, and he groped me. And what surprises me the most, he's groping at 80. Man, it just never goes away. So now he's 105 and he's sick, so he's not groping anymore. And they put him away in a corner someplace, keep the women away from him. And you sort of wonder, okay, if those rumors had been circulating, and it seems that they were, why didn't people say something earlier? Why didn't people leave? And some left. Some did leave. But a lot of them stayed. And is this an appropriate way for a Zen master, a spiritual teacher, reported to be perhaps enlightened, to act? And you know what? It might be. Because he's like not the only Zen guy that's done that. And not the only religious guy that's done that. Remember Rajneesh? You know, 13 Rolls Royces, had a whole army, had a concubine. Wow. These guys, huh? Man. So what's the problem with this enlightenment? Is enlightenment all it's cracked up to be? Do we all want to achieve this and grope at 80? I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Upon thinking about this enlightenment, it seems to me perhaps what's occurring in this enlightenment process is the eradication of boundaries. That our social boundaries are being pulled out and thrown away, dissolving right in front of us. And now we come to the direct experience. They talk about this in Buddhism, of the ultimate reality, which turns out to be the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena. So the sense of self and separateness and boundary falls away. And that's enlightenment. And now, if we're lucky enough to reconstitute and remember the experience, but still have the boundaries that we've been taught since childhood, it might work okay. But what happens if those boundaries don't come back? What happens if that breast you want to grope turns out to be your breast, because now you're interconnected and interdependent with all breasts? My gosh. Problem. Yeah. So, what's the safety measure? You know, what do we need to do to assure that that won't happen in our enlightenment experience? Well, in Chan, in the Chinese Zen, they've come up with the answer. And the answer, the Great Vows. Now, in doing a little research on the Great Vows, they're not talking about the kind of vows I'm going to talk about. They're talking about the Great Vows. Whoa, this is the Bodhisattva ideal. These are the four great vows. These are the vows that enlightened people take because they've had that direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena. The vows are: sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Now, is anyone here into saving them all? I mean, think about how hard that is going to be. Now, I know some people went down and marched to save the earth. But there's like one earth. You know? There are like 7 billion people. So you take the vow to save them all. The next vow you take, deluding passions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. Deluding passions, desire, craving. And they are inexhaustible. Just when you think you're making progress on the path, you've come to this place of stability and equanimity, you see Jennifer Lopez. In my case. And you go, man, I still got work to do. These deluding passions are inexhaustible until nirvana. Dharma gates are limitless. I vow to enter them all. Dharma gates are limitless. The ways we can be taught, the teachers we have access to, are limitless. A wise person once said, there are two teachers in this world, and we have access to all of them, two kinds of teachers. The teachers that show us what to do, and the teachers that show us what not to do. So theoretically, we have 7 billion teachers available to us to learn from. Some we want to be like, others not so much. But what a vow to take, huh? To go through all those Dharma gates, to accept all those teachings. And finally, the Buddha's way is supreme. I vow to attain it. So you take a vow to become a Buddha. Now, the problem with becoming a Buddha is there's only one at a time on earth. There's only one Buddha at a time. And if 7 billion people take a vow to become a Buddha, how long do they have to wait until it's their turn? You know, so numerically, there's an issue, except they figured it out, except that even dust, that little stuff that floats through the air, and if you look at it just right, it gleams in the sunlight, even dust is a world system. And Buddhas live on the dust motes, they call them. And you could be a Buddha on one of those dust motes. My aspiration might be a little bit bigger than that, but still, the vow to become a Buddha is a tough one. Because it's hard to be a Buddha. The next Buddha has already been found, designated. We know who that is. It's Maitreya Buddha. He's in heaven right now, waiting for the last person practicing the teachings of Siddhartha Gautama to die, and then he will be reborn and start the wheel of Dharma turning again. So we don't know who's after that, but I'm thinking a woman is after that. It's time. We've had 28 male Buddhas on earth so far, according to Theravada. And the 29th one is a male as well, so I think 30 is a charm. Okay. I'm sorry?
Are there any suggestions submitted somewhere to choose a woman?
Are there any traditions that would choose a...
Yes, there's a suggestion box.
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of, but if I find one, I'll let you know. And you can make your suggestion to the great Buddhas in the sky. So my vows would be a lot different. Because, I recite those vows every Sunday when I'm at our center, because everybody that comes to our Sunday service recites them. And it's just, you recite them and you feel good. And then you just realize that you will fail. So I am suggesting different vows. I am suggesting the precepts as a vow, the five precepts that every Buddhist takes. And I would also say to you that if Sasaki Roshi had practiced the five precepts, would his legacy have been screwed like it is now? If Rajneesh had practiced the five precepts? If any of these guys who became unskillful in their boundaries had practiced the five precepts, would it have happened? You know what I'm saying? So I think in some ways that the five precepts may be more important than the four great vows. Just saying. So you could say it this way, perhaps. I vow to practice not taking life. Okay, so that'd be a good one to start with. I vow to practice not taking life. Now, it's tough because we kill 140 billion animals a year to eat. Not Holly, but the rest of us. And it's like, okay, how do you stop killing those animals? You know, and then you see people going fishing and hunting to kill for fun. And you go, well, you know. And then you got the cockroaches and the ants and the mosquitoes. How do you not kill them? Their life's not important. Their life agitates my life. You know, so it's that practice could take a lifetime. Just one vow to practice not taking life. A lifetime of practice right there. Second vow, not to take what is not given. Not to steal stuff, you know? And I tell you, most of us don't think that we're stealing stuff, but it's not to take what is not given. So, which is a little different than stealing. So it's not offered to you, it's not yours. And even when it becomes yours, if it's offered, it's not really yours anyway, because you can never own anything in the way you would like to. Ownership is an illusion that's propagated by consumerism. We have receipts. You know, therefore I am, you know. So In looking at this, not to take what is not given would be, okay, I've offered a meal. And this happened at a retreat that I was at. A fellow, not knowing, picked up a monk's apple that had been offered to him for lunch and said, my, this is a wonderful apple. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. And he put it back down. And now the monk couldn't eat the apple because the ownership had been transferred to the person that picked it up. But a wise layperson saw the whole event happen and re-offered the apple so the monk could eat it. Now, the moral of the story is, don't touch monks' food. You know, because they got to eat too. Sexual misconduct. Okay, this is a good one. Four things, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi in the Eightfold Path, we need to avoid. Why do we need to avoid them? Because they increase suffering rather than decrease suffering. We need to avoid having sex with people that are married, sex with people who are engaged, sex with children, and sex with people against their will. Now, you would think after hearing those four things, it would be relatively easy to abide by them. But then you have Kim Kardashian, and you go, well, okay, I like that one. And you go, okay, so what are my boundaries going to be? Can I follow those four, you know, and not mess around with married people? Yeah, I can, yeah. Because they don't want to mess around with me. It works out fine. You know, and actually, the older you get, the less people want to mess around with you. So it becomes easier. So simply following those four, I vow to practice not indulging in sexual misconduct. What a great way to start your day. You know? Walk out that door with confidence so you can make it through the whole day without sexual misconduct. I vow to not speak unskillfully. I want to be kind in my speech. I want to be inclusive in my speech. I don't want to use false speech or harsh speech. I don't want to involve myself in a lot of gossip and idle chatter, even though that's the most fun to talk about. TMZ has made a living off that. And in speaking kindly, we find we probably have less to say. But when we do speak, it's more important and has more value. So not speaking unskillfully is a challenge. For me especially, because I speak a lot. And sometimes I just say like the wrong thing, unintentionally. Or I try to use humor. And humor is a really difficult technique to use in your presentation because everybody thinks stuff is funny, but different stuff is funny. So I sometimes get caught. And then I think to myself, well, why did I say that? And in the context of what I said, in that moment, it made perfect sense, but I was the only one in that context. So it requires me to give a little pre-thought sometimes to what I'm going to say and how I'm going to say it if I want to reduce suffering rather than increase suffering. And then I vow not to consume intoxicants. You know? And we don't need to start off with, like, complete sobriety. We could just do it gradually, like I did when I took that precept for the first time. I said, okay, I'm going to drink, but I ain't going to get drunk. And so instead of having a case of beer, I'd have two beers. You know. And then when I went and got a burrito and chips and salsa, I'd have a beer. And it just was a nice compliment. And it wasn't even about getting high. It was just about tasting good. What a wonderful combination. In Germany, they say beer is food. And it is. It's very nutritional. So why was the Buddha so against humans getting high? And it turns out that getting high steals your wisdom. And you become stupid. And you do things that create more suffering rather than less suffering. So it was all about suffering. It's all about being free. The five precepts allow us to start being free. And you say, but how can that be? If I can't do stuff, how can I be more free rather than less free? Aren't the precepts like a penalty, a prison I'm going to put myself in? There's only one kind of freedom in Buddhism, freedom from suffering. The precepts allow us to be free from suffering. Now, radical concept, yes. Does it really work? Might need a little faith in the beginning. A little skeptical doubt is good too, healthy. You know, I'm going to try not killing and see how it goes, and see if I feel better, and see if the creatures I was going to kill feel better. Well, you know, after a while you realize not killing requires a whole lot of time, because rather than killing the mosquito, you catch the mosquito, take him outside, let him go, you know. And rather than killing the squirrel or the deer that's eating your flowers, you let them go and plant more flowers. You know, it's more time. It's more, it requires more commitment to that precept when you start doing it. But every time you don't kill something, you start to see the value of life. You start to see how important life is and what a miracle it is that we all made it here as human beings. Because they say to be born as a human being is the most precious thing that can ever happen on earth. It's so difficult. With all the different realms of existence where we could have ended up, we made it here. So we had enough good karma to be born as humans. Now the big question comes, at some point in our life, hopefully, what am I going to do with this lifetime? How is my life going to benefit the earth? How is my life going to benefit others? And what do I need to do to have that happen? You know, it's an interesting dilemma we find ourselves in, because we have this potential for self-awareness. And a lot of it starts with, who am I and what am I going to do? And the world's all for me and blah, blah, blah. And if we're lucky enough in our practice to start to self-actualize, we start to maybe even become a little altruistic. Well, how can I help others? How can I save that cat or that dog that doesn't have a home and not have it euthanized? What can I do to make this world a little better place, to have a little less death in it, you know, have a little less thievery in it, et cetera, et cetera? What can I do? That can come out of this practice. And I tell you what, a lot of that stuff comes out of this practice because of the five precepts. So a vow to practice the five precepts is a wonderful way to start your day, and will only enhance your meditation practice, because it lays the foundation for your meditation practice. Without the five precepts, it's like building a two-story house and forgetting the first story. It's not going to work. And maybe in the Zen tradition, and I'm just thinking and saying, maybe in the Zen tradition, with the lack of emphasis on the precepts and the emphasis being on meditation, maybe just meditation isn't all it's cracked up to be. Maybe we get into a place where we feel it's okay, but the 7 billion other people don't quite see it that way. And that can lead to a lot of extra suffering in the world and disillusionment. When your teacher, who you committed yourself to for all these years, turns out to be sort of a jerk. And you go, wow, are there any humans on this planet that have achieved enlightenment? Now, yesterday, I was at Leisure World, where I speak once a month, me and the old people. We're about the same age. And one of the guys said he was reading a book, and the author said there are probably right now on Earth 12 enlightened people. And I said, and one of them works at McDonald's. And everybody sort of chuckled. But think of all the people, and if there's only 12, what are they doing? Where are they? Are we going to recognize them? Are they going to have cool hair? Probably not. Nice shoes? No way. Shop online? Probably. It's cheaper. So it's like, okay, do we really want to be enlightened? Is that going to be our goal? Or do we want to be the best human we can be? Which is what the Buddha turned out to be, I think, with his realization, with his perfection. And being the best human you can be will benefit every other human on this planet. But just being enlightened doesn't seem to offer much to others, except a retreat or two. Now, the last one, great vigor, great determination. Man, this path takes a long time. Some people say God works slowly. Nothing compared to getting enlightened or achieving nirvana. The Buddha was a bodhisattva at least 550 times, according to the Jataka tales. An enlightened being, 550 times. Before that, infinite lifetimes as a regular being in a variety of realms of existence. But finally, he became enlightened, and for 550 rebirths, he became back as enlightened creatures, not always human, but enlightened creatures. And then after all of that, in his last lifetime as Siddhartha Gautama, it still took him 35 years of practice and life in order to achieve his nirvana. So, man, that is a really long time to wait. And I know when I started practicing Buddhism and meditation, I'm thinking 20 years. Man, I'm just going to work hard for 20 years, retreats, I'm going to read books, I'm going to talk to people, I'm going to listen to Dharma talks. It's going to work. I got that feeling, I have that faith that it's going to work, you know. And then after about 10 years, you know, and I finally got out of my polyester and got into some cotton, you know, left behind the hairspray and just went natural. I'm thinking, hey, it's starting to work. I'm going in the right direction. And then another 10 years passed, you know, and you go, man, no, you know, okay, I'm speaking a little bit better, you know, now I've become a monk and don't work anymore, have a lot of extra time to study and practice, but then everybody keeps calling me, wants me to talk, so I go out there, and that takes 4 hours here and 10 hours there, and oh, man, you know, when do I get to practice anymore? I practiced more before than now. Now I'm working, you know. I got a lot of stuff to do. So I'm thinking to myself, I started in 1979, so I've been meditating like over 30 years. And look at me. Not much has changed. Maybe from that 80s picture to now, a lot has changed on the outside. But the inside feels pretty much the same. So why do I still do it? Do I have faith it still might happen? I gave that up. I don't have any more faith it's going to happen. You know, one time I had faith if I brush my teeth good enough and long enough, I'd never get a cavity. I got bridges and crowns and caps. I'm thinking, damn, and I still brush my teeth. Okay, well, I'm not enlightened, I still meditate. I still read the latest book on Buddhism. I still give talks. And why? Because it's become sort of a habit. It's become sort of a lifestyle. Now my practice sort of has its own momentum. And it's just sort of rolling right along whether I want it to or not. At some points in my practice, I have come to the conclusion that I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm just going to opt out. And then I realized I couldn't opt out. I could never go back to how I used to be. I don't know why I'd want to go back to how I used to be, but I could never do that. None of us can. And none of us can stop and just say, I'm not doing anymore, because the impermanence of our life, ever-changing in a constant state of flux, won't let us. There's only one thing all of us can do once we've started, and that's to proceed, to go ahead, to continue. We can't get off. We can't go back. That is scary, because nobody I ever talked to in the beginning said that would be the case. Oh, you don't have to be a Buddhist if you don't want to be. You don't have to meditate if you don't want. You can leave any time you want. We have three periods of meditation. Why don't you leave after the first one? It's more comfortable that way. So now you're staying for three and want four. Just hoping, you know, to make a little more progress. 3-day retreat, now you're going to go for a week now. Because you know if you do a week, you'll be that much closer. But how many more lifetimes? How much closer? And then at some point, you just don't think about it anymore. You just sit, you read, you listen to Dharma talks. Occasionally, you go on a retreat. Anything changing? I don't know. I don't know. And then one day, somebody says, anything changing? And you say, don't know. You've left off the I. something changed. Getting closer now, don't know. So this determination that we need, this great determination, once we've started this practice, we need to continue it even if there are no visible signs of success or change. Because internally, stuff is going on. And then you say to yourself, as they did yesterday at Leisure World, well, what happens when you get Alzheimer's and you can't practice anymore? What are you going to do then? How are you going to die well then? And my answer was, you've got your momentum. If you've been practicing for 20 or 30 or 40 years, you don't have to think about it. It's working. It's working deep. It's important. And that last thought you have will be a good thought of this lifetime, and the first thought of the next lifetime will even be better because you practice in this lifetime. You've prepared yourself to die, which a lot of people aren't really into. But you know what? We all have to die. And why not have a good death? Why not make it good? You know, maybe we'll get lucky and we'll be like golf or tennis, heart attack. Bang. Just like that. Dead on the court. You know? People gave poor son of a bitch and died right there on the court. And you're thinking, great death. Man, no suffering, no 6 years of medication. Bang. Right into the next lifetime. Ready to start again. So as we prepare in our daily practice of vowing to practice the precepts, to do our meditation, to have faith, but also to balance our faith with doubt, if something doesn't seem right, it may not be right. And then they have that determination just to continue, not way in the future, just to continue today. You know, just, okay, I'm doing it today. I don't know about tomorrow, but I'm doing it today. And then today comes again, and you say, I'm doing it today. We don't have to do it tomorrow, because tomorrow never comes. It's only today. Forever and ever and ever. The determination to do today pays off for the rest of your life. I think I covered as much as I need to cover, but does anybody have any questions or comments on what I've said or how I've said it? Yes?
I have a question about the doubt you're talking about.
The great doubt,
yes. The great doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't find myself doubting because I'm so hopeful that this is going to work, that the doubt would take away some of that hope.
Mm.
So I don't doubt.
Okay, well, that's a nice
I'm
way
going to faith.
Yeah, that's a lot of people do that. I think it's wonderful. I have found in Buddhism there is no hope. So so it might be okay to doubt. But what I've also found, and just to make you feel a little more comfortable, what I have found that there is a very much a potential for the doubt to transform into confidence. So what you might be feeling is confidence in the path, confidence in your teachers, confidence in your practice, rather than faith. And therefore, with confidence, that sort of pushes away the doubt.
But I like
because
the
you know it's
doubt.
Working for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of doubt because it brings some balance and perspective, and I feel I don't have that.
Okay.
So you're saying what I call faith would be confidence.
It could be confidence.
Yeah.
That you have proven it to be true for yourself. You have tested the teachings of the Buddha. The Dharma is your prescription to the end of suffering. You have taken that prescription. You have tested it, proven it to be true. And somebody says, well, it doesn't work for me. It doesn't have to shake your confidence. Because you can say, but it works for me. So maybe you need to be a Lutheran.
It feels a little churchy to me.
It sounds a bit churchy?
It sounds a little churchy. It's like I have one faith and I don't doubt it and I just keep walking the path. And
oh, so you know, it's
I've
actually
taught how to doubt.
It's actually a blessing if it's that simple for you. You know, I've always doubted. And it's proven, you know, to give me more work to do. Like, I didn't have faith in Australia. I didn't think Australia existed. I thought it was just a fabrication.
Australia?
Australia. I saw maps, you know, but people drew the maps. I heard people talk funny, and they said that was Australia, but I wasn't sure. Could have been a tribe in Pacoima someplace. You know? So, you know, I just... But then I went to Australia. And now I have confidence that Australia exists because I was there and they called it Australia. How cool is that? So, you know, do you believe in Mars and Pluto? And well, we can't believe in Pluto anymore because it's not a planet. But, you know, do you... So we just take it for granted that those things exist because people told us it was true. And we needed to have cultural literacy. We all needed to learn pretty much the same stuff so we could relate to each other as Americans, you know? But is it all real stuff, or is it just like concepts that have been put on our head that gives us a model in which to experience the world and understand it as an American or as a female or as a male or as a Buddhist or as a Lutheran? What is it? So when you start to do that kind of investigation, what happens, unfortunately, is your black and white world turns into a gray world. And now you're not sure of anything. And that's the great doubt. I don't know anything now. But that's when you finally start to grow as a human being. Because as long as you think you know, you're going to be limited. As soon as you say, I truly don't know, everything becomes a possibility.
But what about when the experience feels right?
What the experience feels like?
Buddhism feels
it feels right.
Right.
Yeah. That's nice. It's nice when it feels right. When I experience butter pecan ice cream, it feels right. So I'm happy. I'm not going to question it. Would, you know, chocolate mint be better? I don't know. Maybe. But I'm, you know, so I don't think, if it feels good, And more importantly, if what you're thinking, doing, and saying is more skillful because of it, then I think you're on the right path. You know, there was a fellow who used to live at our center, who was a Dharma teacher, and he had been practicing for years and years and years, and we're in the laundromat together, and the machine eats his quarters. And there's nobody there, there's a sign with a phone number, and he didn't have any more money with him. And he's cursing and running around. And I thought to myself, how long have you been practicing? So I gave him a quarter just to shut him up, you know. It was weird. That practice wasn't so good for him. Maybe he needed to be something else or have a different kind of practice. So we can gauge how we're doing by how we are responding to the world. And if we're responding, that's really good. If we're reacting, not so good. That's habitual. But if we have changed ourselves enough to have positive habitual patterns in our life, you can't ask for much more than that. That's how I look at it. Helpful? Sort of? You doubt what I have to say? That's good. I encourage that. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah?
I enjoy the confidence that you said can happen with doubt, especially when it, you know, comes to trying to understand how precepts work in your life. If they work for you,
or against you.
Or against you, or just don't seem to make sense. And so if the precepts don't really work for you, you know, sure, you become a Lutheran. But, you know, that's the joke aside, it leaves me with a little bit less of a base, a little bit less of a little less structure. And it's nice to have structure because we build our knowledge off of structure. We can compartmentalize it. So, you know, we don't want to have to pick it. I've always been told that it's a bad idea to pick and choose, right?
Mm-hmm.
Take it all. And then I really enjoy what you said about, I forgot what it was, kind of, but.
Me too.
Yeah, it's okay. When you're actively doubting, you know, you're making a choice about this, and saying, well, this doesn't really fit the mold as I see it, then that doubt can be something that we can build off of. And so I wanted to know if, do they ever talk about building off of that doubt? And you don't, we're not going to build my own Buddhism, but like essentially we all do, right? So.
Well, perhaps a lot of people do build their own Buddhism. You know, they take bits and pieces from all the different traditions, maybe a little yoga thrown in just to make it more exciting. The five precepts to start with are basically not for us. They're for everybody else because we have to live together. So if we lived alone, we wouldn't have to follow those. So that's how I sort of started appreciating how important it was to follow them, to be skillful around others. As far as building off of doubt and don't know, absolutely. But sometimes we're put in the situation of having to know, or at least pretending to know. Now, do you have children? Okay. And they come and ask you a question, do you pretend you know? Because you're an authority figure in their life? They're not old enough to ask those questions. Okay. But one day they may come up and ask, you know, what do you think, Dad, about this? And you're going to have an opinion. But what that turns out to be is simply an opinion or the way you perceive your reality, and you're sharing it with them. And most enlightened parents would give their children a foundation of being somebody and telling them what is right and what is wrong until they're old enough to have discernment and decide what's right and what's wrong. But it is so arbitrary, the right and wrong. It's so depends on consensus, and it's always changing. And so the idea of the foundation of right and wrong being skillful and unskillful related to suffering, more suffering and less suffering, is one that carries me through the day and the weeks and the months, because when I listen to the lawmakers talk about what's right and wrong and the politicians and the religious people, I'm going, yeah, because everybody has a different thing. So we look at it as a relative reality that's useful, allows us to think and understand and live together. The don't know comes from our direct experience of the ultimate, which can't be codified in the way we do with our relative reality. So we just, there's no words to describe it. We can only point at it. We can't talk about it. And in those cases, you can have a spirituality built off that direct experience, but the problem is it may lead you astray. It may lead you into doing things that are unskillful, because your reality now has shifted from simply being relative to also including ultimate. And that may not apply to everyone around you. And so they're going to think of you as being insane or a genius or a spiritual yogi or someone that needs medication. You know, it's really odd. So we need to sort of fit into the mold of American citizen, L.A., blah, blah, blah. Father, husband, blah, blah, blah. So people don't freak out. So people don't get nervous around us. So people don't feel that, you know, we are a cult and we're all, you know, trying to be the Buddha. You know, most people I talk to would like to be the Buddha, but they're happy to be happy. They're happy to have a life that's fulfilling. They like to be loved and liked, and you know, and so that can come from this too. That's a relative reality that can come from it. And the realities of the precepts and the vows and all that kind of stuff builds that, which is a really nice refuge in this crazy world we live in. And then ultimately, there's everything and nothing at exactly the same time. The giant don't know. Yeah, thanks. I hope that that was a little abstract. But.
Yeah, it's discernment. It's huge.
Yeah, good. Good. Well, we've come to the end of our time. I see by everybody's face, ready to start the day. And let me do a loving kindness meditation for all of us, so we can be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May those of us who have come together today, in mind and heart, be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to us. May no difficulties come to us. May no problems come to us. May we always find fulfillment. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May the suffering ones be suffering free, the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief. May the sick find health, relief. Thank you, everyone. And Holly, do you have anything you'd like to share with us?
I do. Thank you all for coming. There's